Let me start with this idea for you. Context is key to understanding everything in life. Context shapes how we see people. Context affects how we listen to people. And context is how we assess the significance of a moment. Let me give an illustration. True story. You might have heard of this man, maybe not. His name is Joshua Bell. Apparently, he's one of the best violinists in the world. His own violin, I think, is a Stradivarius and is worth $3.5 million. He sells out concert halls, and I don't think anyone in this room, myself included, could ever dream of affording a ticket to one of his concerts. He's the best of the best. In 2007, as part of a social experiment, he stood in a New York City subway station and played his violin for 45 minutes, busking with his violin case open in front of him. Rather than his tuxedo, he wore an old pair of jeans and a tattered baseball cap. He was performing one of the most difficult pieces of music ever written for the violin, and over that 45-minute time period he was busking, 1,500 people walked by him, only 7 people stopped to listen, and by the end of the 45 minutes he had maybe $30 worth of change that people had tossed into his violin case. How do you account for the fact that so many people failed to recognize his brilliance? Because people listen to him out of context. In the context of an opera house, he is adored. In the context of a subway station, he was ignored. Without proper context, people fail to recognize the true significance of what is in front of them. That's how important context is. Now, it's not just with people and moments. Sorry, I'm just struggling here a little bit. It's also with words. And so let me write a word on the screen for you. No? There we go. There's your word, current. Now, I want you to tell me how many different meanings this word has depending on its context. So what might the word current mean to you? Someone stick up their hand. Daniel.
The flow of a river.
The flow of a river, thank you. Like a tidal current kind of thing. Good. What else, Craig?
That you put in a cake.
Oh, yeah, like a little raisin or a sultana, a current. Yeah, it can go in cooking. Could be a moment, a reference to a moment in time, like currently we're sitting in this room.
Electricity.
Could be electricity, the flow of electricity through sockets. See, same word, 4 completely different meanings based on the different context in which they were used. Now, of course, this isn't just a fun game with random words. This very much applies with the words we read in the Bible. If we take a word from a word or a sentence or even a paragraph in isolation, if we rip it out of its context, we're likely to lose the author's intention. And in turn, we will obscure or maybe even pervert his intended meaning. Right? A lot rides on context in life as in preaching. So let me put up for us all the principle at work in our context instruction. Here we go. This is it. We must understand how the context informs the meaning of the text. It's very simple. But there's something incredibly important I want you to notice from the get-go. Can someone read out the second question on the worksheet? It's not going to come as a galloping surprise to you, but it helps me make my point. How does the context inform the meaning of the passage? So what is question 2 not asking you to do? Yeah, find all the possible cross-references and relevant bits to your passage and deliver them in a list. Now, it's not asking you to do less than that, but it is asking you to do more than that. It's not saying merely deliver the detail of the context. It's going a step further, and it's asking you, how does that information inform, and that's the key word here, inform the meaning of your passage? If we don't take that second step, then we end up with a lot of information which may be true, but it won't be helpful, because it's not going to take us the next step in our progress along the pathway. So just like with Mervyn's structure instruction, it's not just about the structure, but it's how does the structure reveal the emphasis? In the same way, it's not just about what is the context, but it's how does the context inform the meaning? Yeah? Now, we're going to do some examples of that. Some will be familiar with you, to you, but that's what's at stake. If you're ever worried that you've done the first half of the job of question two, but you haven't done the second half, you can ask a very simple diagnostic question, which is, as I look at the information I have collected on my worksheet under question two, ask, so what? So what? I found all these verses and these references, and they're all legitimate, but so what? What difference does it make? And if you don't think your answer to question two can answer that question, then you may still have some work left to do. Let me ask you a question, though. You can just answer from the floor. What might happen if we fail to allow the context to properly inform the meaning of our text? What could go wrong with our preaching or teaching if we don't let the context properly inform the meaning of our text? Sure. So Nick's kind of making a reference to what we call macro structure, which we're going to tackle a little bit later in our time together. But the point he makes is sound, is one of the dangers in not letting the context inform the meaning is that we may misapply what we preach. Right? You might have made some correct observations, but you might misapply the author's meaning if you don't understand the context into which he was writing. So that's one danger. What's another one? And so, yeah, no, that's awesome. So that's actually the step before Nick's point. Nick's saying we can misapply. What you're saying is we might actually misunderstand it. We might have truth statements in there, but if we misunderstand the author's meaning, we will quite possibly misapply the purpose of it. Of course, the other one is that we risk misrepresenting God. You can misunderstand the author's meaning, you could misapply the author's meaning, and as a result, you may actually misrepresent God. Have you ever said in frustration, in conversation with someone else, hey, don't, that's so unfair. You can't take my words out of context like that. Right? Have you ever said that when you've been misrepresented? It's not a nice feeling. Well, we're going to work hard on this step in the time given to us today, so that God need never say that of us. Okay, now we've got a picture here to help us remember exactly where we are. Oh, I knew I was going to do that. You know, sometimes you can see a mistake as you're doing it, but you still do it anyway? No. Okay. Illustration. This is not the cross of Jesus. This is the letter T. It stands for your text. Okay. I'm going to write text because now I've said it's not the cross. It looks like the cross. Like, don't think of pink elephants. Okay. So here's a picture for us just to consider. It's the one that goes along with this instruction. This picture reminds us that your text never stands in isolation. And we would be foolish to treat a text in isolation. I didn't even raise this. Nikki, can you stand up? Yeah, you know what I'm about to do. Turn around and face everybody and let them read your T-shirt. Have you seen Nick's T-shirt? Nick, can you say out loud what's on your T-shirt?
Yeah, it felt right for the
Sydney
intro.
Yeah, good. I can do all things through a verse taken out of context. Absolutely. So we never want to do that, so we want to make sure that every text is placed in its proper context. Now, there are multiple concentric circles here because context is not one thing. There are different types of context and therefore different strategies we can use to identify these different types of context. So your text will always live within a broader literary unit, which is just a fancy way of saying there will be bits of Bible before your passage and bits of Bible after your passage. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But it also lives within a historical background. It happened in a certain time and place, and that's very relevant for how the author wrote and how the first readers received it. It's also possibly surrounded by certain cultural details that were relevant to the first hearers. They may not be that relevant to us. Well, let me say, they may not be that familiar to us, but they may still be very relevant for us. And then lastly, your text may well include references in it that forge a connection with a previous part of Scripture. So there are multiple layers of context. And these four areas that I've described just very generally have a name, a label. So we want to talk about our literary context. We're going to talk about historical context. We can talk about cultural context. And we can talk about our biblical context. Okay? Now, those are the four types of context, and of course, therefore, there will be different strategies for discerning these different types of context, and that is where we're going to give our attention now. So let's take the first one. Let's talk about literary context. And as I've mentioned, this simply refers to the literature. That's how I remember it, literature, literary. The literature that comes before and after your text. So just what comes before, what comes after. You can think about this by asking the question, as I read around my text, before and after, what is the larger conversation that's going on here? And how does that larger conversation inform the meaning of my passage? And I think this works everywhere. But it makes a lot of sense for us in Romans, right? Because Paul's always asking a new question. Okay, now, let's talk about this. But what about that? Now, you might say, but I've just said. And so the conversation is broad and sometimes spans more than one chapter. And you may only be preaching a piece of that. So literary context, very important. Let's have a look as an example. Here's, by the way, I'm going to do some quick, short examples for each of the four. Then we're going to look at one text from Romans and do all four in that one text. Yeah? Okay. So just these ones are quick fire, just to embed the concept, and then we'll put it to work in a larger worked example. So turn with me to Romans chapter 1, verse 16. And remember, the question here is, how does the literary context inform the meaning of this verse? Can someone read for us Romans 1:16? Thank you very much. Now, the first word in verse 16, for, which direction does that point us as we consider the broader literary context? Forward or back?
Back.
So Paul said something, and now he's developing his argument with this linking word for. So immediately we go, well, what has he just said? So here's the question for you. What does the four point us back to? And I want you to cast your eyes particularly to verses 13 and 14. Let me read it for you. I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that I've often intended to come to you, but thus far I've been prevented, in order that I might reap some harvest amongst you, as well as amongst the rest of the Gentiles. For I am under obligation to both Greeks and to barbarians, the wise and the foolish. So I'm also eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. Now, how does those preceding verses help inform the meaning of our verse, verse 16? So Tommy's picked up the not ashamed and linked it into 13 and 14, that Paul is willing and eager to continue spreading the word. He's not ashamed to do that. Look at the Jew and the Gentile reference in verse 13 and 14. Paul wants a harvest of both Jews and Gentiles. All right? He wants to speak to both groups and see both groups become Christians. And so if his focus is on Jew and Gentile, which word in verse 16 would be deserving of emphasis?
Everyone.
Paul's just gone to some length in the previous couple of verses to say, I've got an obligation, a desire, a burden to reach the Gentiles, but I'm coming to you also in Rome, and my goal is to Greeks and to Greeks and barbarians and everyone on every level. I want all of you. Now, with that in mind, when we read verse 16, it can direct our attention that it is salvation for everyone who believes. So if you were doing the Bible reading in church on this passage, then you would know which word to emphasize as you read the Bible to the people, because the context has informed where Paul's emphasis lies. Now, interestingly, verse 18 goes on, just by way of a quick aside, verse 17, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness. So Paul is wanting to preach the gospel to all people, to everyone, verse 16. And then if you look forward, we've looked back, but if you look forward to the next part of the text, it's because unrighteousness is characteristic of all. So because all are under wrath, all need to hear the gospel. So that's moving on either side of our text with literary context in order to see some connections and to see how those markers inform our understanding of verse 16. Let's move on to historical. Literary context. Let's move on to historical context. Now, historical context refers to the circumstances of the author and their first readers. It's the answer to the question, what was going on in their world when this text was written? Not in the world, because I don't know what was happening in China and Australia at this point, but what was happening in their world that was relevant for them, that was a pressing issue on them, that both the author, Paul, as well as those in Rome were aware of. A shared understanding between the two, what was going on in their world. Now, how might you discover what the historical context might have been in our setting in the letter to the Romans? There's a few different ways you could do it. So you want to survey the broader passage, maybe even the entire book, and you want to pick out all the references to when he describes or makes an allusion to something going on in their world that is relevant for his argument. So you can just read through the whole book a couple of times, and you can just jot down any reference to anything that was happening in their world. Okay? And we'll do a quick example of that just now. Now, sometimes you will reap quite a lot of benefit by reading through the book that you are preaching from. There are other occasions where your book will have a companion book. So if you're preaching on 2 Corinthians, you're probably going to want to give 1 Corinthians a speed read, because whatever the issues were there are probably going to be relevant for the second letter, right? There are also other ways that books are paired. So, for instance, if you were reading Ruth or Judges, you might want to read the other one there as well, because they fall in a very similar historical time period, right? And there's actually a reference to that in Ruth. And so sometimes you get companion books which sit historically next to each other or on top of each other even, and so that can be helpful. Sometimes it's just in the book itself. Sometimes you can go outside of the Bible book and you can consult a commentary or another book. Now, I'm not going to give you an example of that here for historical. I am going to mention an example of where that might be helpful in cultural context. And sometimes that is very helpful. But I'll get to that in a minute. But let me just encourage you that you don't have to own a lot of books. You don't have to be a big reader. You don't have to be a student of history to get benefit from the historical context. Because most of the time, the value can be found within the book you're studying. So don't sweat that. Huh? Yes. Book of Acts obviously touches on so many, even Romans. Someone in our group today was talking about Romans, Acts 18 verse 2, where it talks about the emperor kicking all the Jews out of Rome, and then later on they got to return, which is kind of relevant, broader historical context for the dynamic between Jews and Gentiles by the time Paul is writing. I'm going to give you four verses, and these are very, very simple questions. This is not rocket science. This is just to demonstrate the point. It's not going to be a huge aha moment, but let's just do it anyway. Write down these verses. Chapter 3, verse 1. Chapter 11, verse 13. Chapter 1, verse 10 to 11. Chapter 15, verse 24. Just around the tables, just flip to those verses, have someone around the table read it. Most of them are single verses. And then here's the question: what can you learn about the author and the first readers from these references? Okay, I'm going to write the question on the board as well. But you can start the work now. These are easy questions, so I'm going to bring us back together. If you didn't finish, don't worry. Someone stick up their hand and tell us, what do we learn about the author and their first readers from chapter 3, verse 1? Some of them were Jews. Thank you. I told you it was easy. Paul is speaking to Jewish Christians. So that's something historical about the context. Those are his first audience. What do we learn about the historical context from chapter 11, verse 13? Some of them were also Gentiles as well. There you go. You're doing so well. What do we learn about the context from chapter 1, verse 10 to 11? Paul hasn't actually been to Rome yet, but he hopes to be there soon. So that's relevant. And what do we learn from 15:24? Paul is trying to piggyback to Spain and he wants the assistance of the church in Rome. Okay? Now, no one of those verses is going to fix your sermon for Sunday, but as you're preaching through the book of Romans, you're going to appreciate this broader historical context and other things are going to start making, why is Paul banging on about this thing? Why does he keep asking all these ridiculous questions? Well, with this historical context, it starts to become a bit more obvious. Okay, let's move on to cultural. And a nice way to start the definition of cultural context is with a wonderful observation. The Bible is written for you, but it is not written to you. By which I mean you were not the first audience of Paul when he wrote this letter to Rome. So what that means is there will inevitably be things in every Bible book that the author speaks of which will make sense to him but will be foreign to us because we didn't live 2,000 years ago. If someone were to listen in on a phone conversation you have today with a friend in 1,000 years' time, you're going to be making all sorts of references And they're going to be saying, what in the world are they talking about? Because that thing doesn't exist anymore. Because it's 1,000 years later. Maybe it's a prophecy. Ideas or details particular to that time that we don't find relatable. That's what cultural context is. It's referencing ideas or realities particular to that time that we don't find relatable. In other words, the everyday life stuff in the ancient world that is no longer obvious to us. Now, there are some cultural contexts which are relevant to inform the meaning of your passage in the book of Romans, but I'm not going to talk about them because they come up in a later small group assignment and I don't want to blow the cover. So I'm just going to step outside of Romans very quickly for a very, it's a very obvious one. It works really well, I think, for this example. So quickly, let us turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And someone can read for us verses 3, 4, and 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 11. And someone read 3, 4, and 5. Thank you. Well, that's as clear as mud, isn't it? So let me ask you a question. What behavior does Paul reference in this text that is a cultural practice? Yeah, it's about what you do or don't put on your head, right? Now, presumably, Paul knew what he was talking about, and the people in Corinth knew exactly what he was talking about. The problem is, it's not entirely clear to us what he was talking about, because that was a particular cultural practice which is quite foreign to us. In summary, apparently men shouldn't cover their head while praying or prophesying, because it dishonors their head, whatever that means. And a wife must cover her head, or she will dishonor her head. Oh my goodness. So, where could we go to find help for understanding what this cultural context is, let alone how it informs the meaning of the text? So how do you even find out what's going on here? Where might you go? Maybe there's something in the Old Testament, sure, so you could do a bit of an Old Testament search, that might help. You could look within the book itself, right? You could look throughout the rest of 1 Corinthians and go, does Paul explain this head covering stuff elsewhere? I don't think he does. But here's the example I was referencing earlier, that sometimes it's okay to step out and pick a book off your shelf that's going to help you, a reference book. It might be a commentary. The one that I've often borrowed off Mervyn's shelf, which has been very helpful, and is probably essential reading if you're preaching through 1 Corinthians. It's by a guy called Bruce Winters, and the book is called After Paul Left Corinth. And the whole point of the book is to talk about historical and cultural context, the stuff that we just don't get. Now, if you were to read that book, here's what Bruce would tell you. He would say, look, what is not immediately obvious to us is that at the time, the Roman emperor, when he was praying to his gods, would pull the corner of his toga and drape it over his head as a sign of his mediatorial role between earth and the heavens. Covering your head signifies that you were the mediator between man and God. So for men to do that in church, Christian men to do that in church, sends a terrible signal. Because what does that say about Jesus? Jesus is our great high priest. He is the mediator. And yet if a man were to cover his head, maybe in imitation of the emperor, maybe to conform to his culture, he would be sending out a signal that is only true of Jesus and is not true of the man standing and praying in church. And that would be a bad idea. So Paul says, don't do it. You dishonor your head, not meaning this thing. You dishonor your head, meaning Jesus, who is your head, because he's the only mediator. Okay, now that's starting to make some sense. We can work with that, right?
And verse 3 tells us that the head of every man is Christ.
There you go.
In that verse, we don't understand that.
Yeah. The married woman's head covering, Bruce will tell you, was a bit like a wedding ring. So married women would wear something, we don't know what exactly, but something on their head just as an indicator that she was married and in a relationship and she was attending church, acknowledging that relationship in a really good, healthy way. Just a cultural thing, but it was fine. So to take off her head covering in church would dishonour her head. And as Mervyn pointed out, verse 3 says her head in this case is not Jesus. It's not a Jesus problem. It's a problem with her husband. She's effectively saying, no, you're not head in this relationship. I'm my own woman. It might have been motivated by kind of an independent, sort of feminist streak within Corinth itself. It implied that she didn't recognise his headship over her in church and maybe even aligned her to promiscuous women who never covered their head and even shaved their hair to show that they were available. Right now, I never would have known that had I not reached out for a book to help me. Let me reassure you, most of the time you get it from the Bible book, so we're fine. But if on the occasion you're totally stumped with some weird thing that they're talking about, don't sweat it, just reach for a book. Do a little bit of background reading, it'll take you half an hour, and you might just find a key that opens it up so that then it can inform the meaning of your passage and not completely confuse the meaning of your passage. There you go. That's a cultural context example. And then lastly, let's look at biblical. Biblical context will get you asking, does my text refer to something else that has previously happened in the Bible? Now, that can take the form of a couple of things. It could appear in the form of a direct quote, or maybe you call it a citation, right? A direct quote. Or it could take the form of an allusion, not an illusion, something that's not real, an allusion meaning a reference, an indirect reference. It's not a technical quote, but it's saying, hey, you know, like what happened with Moses at the bush? Yeah, it's that kind of thing here, right? If you were to read something like that, you'd say, okay, this is not a direct quote, but it's an allusion to, say, an event or a person or a phenomenon that happened in the Old Testament that apparently is going to be important to inform the reading of my passage. Now, just a few things to say about this very briefly, so we don't go into the long grass on it. Biblical context can only ever refer backward to something chronologically that was written before. Because obviously the writer of your text didn't have access to something that came after him. You follow? So if you're reading in the Old Testament, biblical context can never be something in the New Testament because the New Testament wasn't written yet. So the Old Testament couldn't be. The Old Testament might prophesy and anticipate, but it will never quote Galatians. Galatians might quote the Old Testament, but not vice versa. You follow? And so that brings us to the other thing that we just need to be mindful of, is when we're talking about biblical context, we're not talking about biblical theology, if that phrase means something to you. Biblical theology is great, a very useful tool, especially along the top of our pathway, along theological reflection. But what that does is that tracks how themes develop throughout the scripture. What we're talking about here is something different. We're talking at the connection that the author is making with something that happened previously in the Bible. Here's the emphasis. It's a connection the author is making. It's not a connection that you make. Yeah, because biblical theology will deal in themes and ideas and movements. Biblical context will deal with quotes or allusions to the event. Okay, so there we go. Literary, historical, cultural, biblical. No wonder question 2 dominates your worksheet, right? But here's what we're going to do in the time left to us. Turn to Romans chapter 4, verse 1 to 12. I'm still in 1 Corinthians. That's not going to help anyone. And we are, very quickly, going to try and see how all of these strategies can come to bear on one text, just like as if you were doing a worksheet, right? I'm just going to read it because I read quickly and we're probably familiar with it. So the point of the exercise is what comes next. So let's have a look at chapter 4, Romans. What then shall we say was gained by Abraham, our forefather, according to the flesh? For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. Now to the one who works, his wages are not counted as a gift, but as his due. And to the one who does not work, but believes in him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted as righteousness. Just as David also speaks of the blessings to the one to whom God counts righteousness apart from works. Blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man against whom the Lord will not count his sin. Is this blessing then only for the circumcised or also for the uncircumcised? For we say that faith was counted to Abraham as righteousness. How then was it counted to him? Was it before or after he'd been circumcised? It was not after, but before he was circumcised. He received the sign of circumcision as a seal of the righteousness that he had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. The purpose was to make him the father of all who believe without being circumcised, so that righteousness would be counted to them as well, and to make him the father of the circumcised, who are not merely circumcised, but who are also walk in the footsteps of the faith that our father Abraham had before he was circumcised. The poor person who reads this passage in church will never say the word circumcised as many times again in a sentence, in a conversation as they have now. Okay, so here's our text. Let's start with some considerations around literary context. Let's have a look at the passage before. Specifically, I want you to have a look at chapter 3, verse 28 and verse 30. And I want you to discuss around your tables what in these verses is essential to Paul's argument. You can combine it into one thing. Just because there's two verses doesn't mean there's two things. But verse 28 and 30, what is essential to Paul's argument at this point in the letter? Just have a quick look and a quick discuss amongst yourselves. Okay, so just give a little bit of feedback. What is the essential part of Paul's argument at the end of chapter 3? In verse 28 and 30. Justification is by faith and not by law. Yeah? So we hold that one is justified by faith apart from works of the law, and everyone is justified by faith. That's key to Paul's argument at this point in the letter. So what question does that then raise in verse 31, the very last verse in chapter 3? Should we even bother with the law? Do we just junk the whole thing? If the law doesn't get you justified, what's the point? That's a fair question. Now, that's our literary context before our passage. But of course, remember the question. How does the literary context inform our understanding of chapter 4? So how would you answer that question now? Given that Paul has made a crucial part of his argument, you're justified by faith, not law, and then he's preempted their objection, yeah, but what happens to the law then? Should we just get rid of it?
He appeals to the forefather Abraham that he was saved by faith.
Yeah, he appeals to the one person in the Old Testament who had an experience before law. Before the law was given, Abraham had a relationship with God and was declared righteous. So he is now bringing an illustration by way of an example to answer his question. So the problem has been posed in chapter 3, and now the evidence for Paul's answer is given with illustration in chapter 4. And so that is going to really inform our reading of chapter 4. If you were given chapter 4, 1 to 12 to preach next Sunday, and you started your work in chapter 4, verse 1, your preparation, you would be lost, wouldn't you? Because what you're getting is an answer without a question. And in order to appreciate the significance of the answer and the illustration and all the various references, Surely at least you, the preacher, if not your people in the pews, that's up to you how much you disclose to them, but surely you need to know what's happening at the end of chapter 3. We've got a big problem and a big question, and chapter 4 is the answer and illustration that Paul gives to that. So there you go. Just one little step, literary context, how the end of chapter 3 informs our understanding of what chapter 4 is even doing in the book in the first place. That's already going to orientate you in a really helpful position. That's literary. Let's look at historical. Same text. And again, this will be very familiar to us, so it's not going to take very long. What are the particular circumstances of the readers of this letter that might help inform the answer that Paul gives in chapter 4? What is the big dynamic at play in the Church of Rome? We know it well by now. It's the Jew and Gentile conflict, right? And so who do you think Paul is directly addressing in chapter 4, verse 1? This message will land with the Jews. Let me talk to you about Father Abraham. Right? And every Jew in the room is like, I've got you, Paul. I'm with you. Let's talk about Abraham. There are Jews in the church concerned about what the implications of Paul's gospel will have on the place of Old Testament law. Now, Paul's quite pastoral here, isn't he? There's a legitimate concern that the Jews in Rome have, and Paul doesn't dismiss them. He explains it to them. He says, look, this is going to be a struggle for you guys. I get it. I'm Jewish myself, says Paul. So he says, let me talk you through how this plays out so you don't freak out and you don't freak other people out. Okay? But what happens in verse 11? I'm going to go 11b. There's a sideways reference to other people. What is the sideways reference and who's it referring to?
Because of father of Gentiles.
Yeah, the purpose was to make him the father, that's Abraham, of all who believe without being circumcised. Now, it doesn't say the word Gentile, but it's obviously talking about the Gentiles. So if you're a Gentile sitting in church as this letter from Paul was read out and you hear the beginning of chapter 4, well, let's talk about Abraham, and you're like, oh, this flipping Abraham guy again, all the Jews, my Jewish friend talks about Abraham, 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 and you're sitting there rolling your eyes, all of a sudden you hear Paul starts talking about those who are not yet circumcised and how Abraham can be your father too. And you go, oh my goodness, that's incredible. Am I in on this as well? You see, historical context. Circumcised, uncircumcised, knowing the setting of the church informs how it lands with its readers, both its first readers, and then how it informs our understanding of that in our more contemporary setting. Okay, staying in chapter 4, let's look at cultural. Remember, cultural is ideas or details that were relevant to their time that may have either changed or are different now in our context. Is there any cultural reference in this text to a practice that we would benefit reflecting on?
Maybe a seal?
So he does talk about a seal. Now, that's olden day stuff. We don't seal with wax anymore, so maybe that'd be something worth just pointing out to people. There's something a bit more fundamental going on here, though. Circumcision. Now, that's not foreign to us in the sense that we don't know what that is, but here's the problem. It's actually very relevant in South Africa, isn't it? Certainly for a lot of South Africans, circumcision is still a very actively practiced cultural phenomenon. But here's the problem. Does circumcision mean to a Old Testament Jew what it means to a 21st century African man? So, some of you guys are shaking your heads. Help a brother out. Help the Australian out down the front. If you, and even at your church among Christian friends, were to talk about circumcision in your cultural context, what would that be referring to, or what ideas are associated with that? What it's about? What is it about? What is it for? Just briefly. Yeah. So it's a coming of age moment. So we, and I think most of us are familiar with our South African context around that. Is that what circumcision meant in Romans chapter 4? No. Now, we know that. But as you're using that word in its Romans chapter 4 context, what might your people be hearing? They might be hearing that word in their African coming-of-age context. They might be getting very confused, and that would be completely understandable. And so I'm not here to offer any answers or solutions to this particular circumcision question, but I just wanted to use it. I think it's actually a great example, because if you realise that your modern South African audience will make a different assumption or conclusion about a cultural practice in the Bible, then you need to in some way factor that into your thinking as you preach the text. You might ask yourself, how will this dynamic and word create confusion for them? How could I address that in the sermon to bring clarity so that Paul's argument is actually the argument they hear? I'm not saying that if you preach Romans chapter 4, you've got to address the particular cultural family pressure issues of circumcision for a Christian man in an African context. That's a very important conversation to have. I wouldn't do it in this sermon, but you just need to be mindful that there's overlapping cultures, modern and ancient, and you need to be mindful of that as you preach. Yeah? So how does the cultural context inform the meaning of the text? African circumcision doesn't help you understand Romans 4, but it will help you preach it so that you don't misinform your people or leave them with misinformation that they have just assumed. Okay. Lastly, very much lastly, biblical. And I would like to work this with you, but I'm just going to point it out to you because I've run out of time. Biblical context. Now, this is a great example text because it's the one-stop shop. What is a biblical allusion that Paul uses in this passage? Give me a verse. Oh, sorry. I mean, give me the verse in Romans chapter 4 where he makes a biblical allusion.
Verse 7?
Yeah, I'm going to come back to verse 7. I'm going to say verse 1, 2, and 3. Because what shall we say was gained by Abraham, our forefather? For if Abraham did this, if Abraham did that. Is he quoting any particular text? No. He's just talking about a guy from the Old Testament called Abraham. And he says, Abraham did this first, he did that second. God acknowledged this before he acknowledged that. And so all he's doing, he's making an allusion. He's saying, think back to Abraham. This man is going to be very important as my illustration to make my point. So he starts with an allusion, then he moves into a biblical quote or citation. We see that in verse 3. And how do we know that we're about to read a biblical quote in verse 3? For what does the scripture say? And then helpfully our English puts it in inverted commas. And then again, we get it in verse 6 and leading into verse 7. Just as David also speaks. It's a quote. And then helpfully it's embedded, verse 7 and 8 from the Psalms. So we've got a biblical allusion, we've got a biblical citation. And again, I'm just going to give this information to you rather than do it through question and answer for the sake of time. That's only step one though, right? That's not the answer. We've identified the biblical context. Well done us. But now we need to push further and say, how does that inform the meaning of the text? So then we need to say, well, verse 10, faith came before circumcision for Abraham. And so therefore righteousness couldn't have come by him keeping the law. And verse 11, therefore Abraham was not just the father of the Jewish nation, but as a result, he becomes the father of people who believe from every nation. So you've got to ask, why would Paul reference Abraham? What weight does Abraham carry? How does Abraham help Paul make his argument? And then look at the particular references, if it's a quote or a citation, why pick that verse? And what does that verse contribute to Paul's argument? And in answering that question, then you find out how the biblical context informs Paul's argument in 1 to 12. Whew. We must understand how the context informs the meaning of the passage. And remember, let the worksheet be your guide and don't merely identify the context, but try to figure out the so what. How does it inform the meaning? And if that means tonight you go home and you slightly change question two, if you're presenting tomorrow, absolutely fine. Knock yourself out, put it into practice, see how it works. Okay.